The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
I'm sorry about your daughter, Joel.
I'm sorry about your daughter, Joel. But I have lost people, too.
You have no idea what loss is.
You have no idea what loss is.
Everyone I have cared for has either died or left me. Everybody, fucking except for you. Don't tell me that I would be safer with someone else, because the truth is, I would just be more scared.
Beware, spoiler phobes! You have stumbled into a storm of spoilers, a podcast currently covering The Last of Us Season 2 and split into two sections. The first section of the podcast we call The Calm, where we can only talk about things that happen on the series up to Season 2, Episode 2, through The Valley. The second section of the podcast we call The Storm, as in a storm of spoilers, where we talk about adaptation changes from The Last of Us Part 2, The Game, and speculate on what we might see in the remaining episodes of this season and beyond. We're not ruining, we're enriching, and we're not infected yet. Why, hello, I'm Dave Gonzalez.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I am delighted to welcome you back to A Storm of Spoilers. And before we get into it, though, Dave, I've got a little bit of housekeeping. Upcoming on this particular podcast that you're listening to, we're, of course, going to be continuing our journey with The Last of Us Season 2. Episodes drop on Wednesday, just as this one did. We'll be back, of course, next week for episode 3, where I'm sure nothing bad is going to happen to any of the characters we like.
Only great things.
Only good things from here on out. Also, very important, if you are tempted to get into the storm now that you know that bad things are potentially happening all over the place in this show, I have been streaming the video game upon which this show is based on my Twitch channel, twitch.tv/Neilstradamus. That is NEILSTRADOMUS. Every Monday evening, had a really great stream that we're going to talk about mostly in the storm this week. But next Monday, 8 p.m. Central Time on my Twitch channel, I'm going to pick it up where I left off. And Dave, I'm not going to say too much. Obviously, I don't want to spoil anything, but I have a feeling, because of the way the game is structured, there's a lot of a little bit of non-linear storytelling happening in the game. Next week's stream may include, if my math is correct, some of the events that could be the climactic or ending moments of this season of television.
Oh, you're getting to that game pretty fast.
There's still plenty of game left, but they're just, like I said, the game is sort of non-linear in the way it's broken down. So we may actually see some of the end of the season story next week with still plenty of game to play. So if you're curious, join us. Big things are happening on the stream. And thanks to everybody who came out this week. We had a really fun is a relative term, of course, stream Monday night. So, good times over there. Also, if you'd like to get more from Dave and I, you can join us, of course, at patreon.com/DaveandNeil, DaveandNeil, for more content, our past Twin Peaks rewatch, all of the previous content from this feed, our Game of Thrones era, our Lost rewatch. You could get access to our wonderful Slack, which is the most enjoyable place on the internet. And you also get weekly pop culture adventure episodes that Dave and I are doing, where we go deep on a movie. We talk about other things that we're watching. We talk about video games that we're playing. It's great. And here's another bonus. If you sign up at the $10 or more level, the small council level, for named for our Game of Thrones fans, you will get access to our podcast that we're doing, watching The Leftovers for the first. Dave and I both for the first time. We jumped into The Leftovers 10 years late. We have made it into season 3, and we are having a blast rolling through Damon Lindelof's what I'm told is the best the season of television maybe that he has ever written. And so far, so good. So join us over there on the Patreon. We're having a really great time. And yeah, that's where you can find more of our work. Now on to this podcast. Hey. We'll start with segment one, which is called We Talked About This Already / Send a Raven. Of course, you can get in touch with our show by emailing stormofspoilers at gmail.com. Dave, I have some sad news. We did not get any emails this week, and it affected
me. One wanted to talk about one of the saddest episodes of television ever.
Yeah. It affected me emotionally, though. I woke up today and I was like getting the notes prepared, and I sort of spiraled when I opened up the email and saw that we didn't get any. I was like, oh no, did we make a mistake? Like, are there too many Last of Us podcasts? Does nobody care about what we have to say? Does nobody want to talk to us or say anything to us? And I was like very sad for a minute. And then I remembered that, like, you know, people are busy, and that's fine. And then I went and I prepped the second part of this segment, which is, folks, you can, of course, leave us a review or a comment. Please leave us a 5-star rating if you can on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and then say whatever you want in the review. And I found this review, which immediately raised my mood personally. And this review, a 5-star review from J-Dog, and I quote, "Thank goodness the boys are back. I was gutted when Trial by Content was canceled. Now I can happily continue respectfully listening to my podcast boyfriend, Neil. Dave is great too, but my heart belongs to the sultry tones of one Neil Miller." So thank you, J-Dog. You rescued my crash out that I was having over the fact that we did not get any emails. For the rest of you, a little bit of homework for next week. Send us an email, stormofspoilers@gmail.com. Let us know what you think. Ask us questions. They can be calm, they can be storm. Whatever you have to say about this show, we greatly appreciate it. Which brings me to the end of the very short Send a Raven segment this week, which means we could talk about this episode, Dave. I'm sure there's plenty to say.
Oh boy, there is a lot to say on this week's episode. For those of you that ventured into the storm with us with our two returning leftovers, season two episodes, the preview, and then of course last week's,
we knew I was gonna do it.
Took me two episodes into season two. We were expecting this big event because, as it's been, you know, described by the creators of the show, Neil Druckmann and Craig Mazin, this is sort of the beginning of the story in a certain type of way, or the beginning of the rest of the story. This is a large pivot point for The Last of Us narrative. And so we were kind of wondering, when would it happen? If on our preview episode, I think we were like, what if they save it till the end of the season? Mm-hmm. But they did not. Instead, what they did is parts, very from my understanding and a little bit of rewatching I've done this week, parts of it they kept very close to the video game. Mm-hmm. And parts of it they made really smart adaptation choices. Maybe the smartest adaptation choices The Last of Us has made yet, from my perspective. And I would like to talk to you specifically about two of them.
Okay.
Here in the calm. One is, on the TV show, we kind of know Abby's motivations for what she does to Joel in this episode. And she gets a monologue about it. We get the sort of opening, the Abby on Abby dream state, where she's trying to save herself from going through further trauma of this discovery she made of her father with her, apparently his brains on the ground. That is sort of absent and withheld from you in the game. And my understanding is, with the interview Craig Mazin gave to Polygon, that sort of like bringing her further in to the beginning of this story takes the place of a part of the game where you play as her, and naturally while you're crawling under that fence and the cordyceps zombies are pushing in through the fence, you naturally empathize with her because she is you. Mm-hmm. Whereas here they had to give it more of a narrative push. But I think also while doing that, they happen across this brilliant idea of Abby sliding down the hill, trying to get a closer look at who the raider or who the scouting party is she's supposed to be looking at, and causing sort of like the Cordyceps horde to be awakened from under the ground. Do you like how much we know about Abby at this point? And how do you think that's going to give us benefits moving forward?
I like it for two reasons. One, this is a TV show, and the TV yes. audience is very different, I think, from the in the video game. You have, as a storyteller, if you're writing this video game, you know that you have a lot more room, and you have POVs that you're going to be able to play with as the game goes on. You know, you're going to be able to put the audience, the player in Abby's shoes, and you could kind of take your time, right? And sort of use that POV to your advantage. The TV audience, especially folks who have not played the game, they're not going to be able to sort of live in that ambiguity quite as long, right? You got to get to the exposition a little bit more, right? We have to hold, unfortunately, I guess, we have to hold their hands a little bit more. So I think it's a function of it being a television show, and I think it still works. It ultimately leads to also Abby having a slightly longer and more involved monologue, right? And it leads mm-hmm. to, like in the game, Joel really doesn't get a whole lot of information about why Abby is doing this. Like, he has a similar reaction in the scene in the game, right? He's sort of defiant and resigned to what's about to happen. Like, he gets it. He's like, clearly I have wronged you, but he doesn't understand. He doesn't know that they're the Fireflies. He just sort of knows that they were obviously looking for him. And so I think having Abby sort of spell it out for him a little more is helpful for the audience. It makes it even more tragic for Joel. And I absolutely think it works. And then I really like the fact that they were able to create this sort of Siege of Jackson as this secondary plot that's happening around Joel's death, because it's a fun way to sort of level up the drama. You know, it's not just this storm hitting and something terrible is happening at this lodge a mile away. There's an urgency that Joel and Dina are experiencing of needing to get to safety and then maybe try to get back to Jackson, that I felt made my skin crawl even more as somebody who knew what was coming, right? Because I was like, oh man, this is even worse than it was yeah. in the game. Because in the game, it's like, it's a similar situation where they find Abby. It's actually Joel and Tommy in the game, but they find Abby. She's like, you know, they're running from the infected. They have to get to safety. She's like, my friends are at this place, at this lodge. And they go there, and then basically plays out the same way. But in, you know, here, you know, there's this extra layer of dread that Joel really doesn't, he wants to be getting back. And I think I also like that by extending it a little bit, we get more of Abby manipulating the situation once she finds out that she's with Joel.
Right.
We get a little bit more of her thinking on her feet and having to manipulate the situation to get Joel up to the lodge, right? I mean, I think I saw there was this tweet that I responded to where somebody was like criticizing this Caitlin Dever's performance, which is insane. She's great.
Yes.
And they were like, oh, she goes from like zero to psycho killer so quickly. It's not believable. And I was like, that doesn't read to me. This is a young woman who has spent the last 5 years of her life thinking about doing this one thing, right?
Right.
Yeah. And I think the episode spends a lot of time showing us how committed she is once she is in the presence of Joel to doing this one thing, right? She's going to do whatever she needs to do to get him isolated in a place where she can kill him very slowly. And I think it's incredibly effective and also, you know, very cinematic that she wakes up a whole horde of infected and ultimately leads to this huge Watchers on the Wall, Hard Home-esque moment for Jackson. And I think I'm also completely fine with them changing the fact that Tommy isn't there. You know, Tommy's obviously not going to be happy about losing his brother either way. But I think it was a far more interesting and cool situation for him to be helping defend Jackson. I know there's a, there's a scene that we sort of lose out on with, because in the game, Ellie and Dina are together instead of Ellie and Jesse. And they have this sort of like tender moment that they're having while Joel and Tommy are going missing. But I think there's still plenty of time for Ellie and Dina to have tender moments as we go forward, because, you know, they're both still alive, deeply traumatized, but still alive.
Oh, yeah. And I think, you know, we have, based on, you know, simple things like the trailer and whatnot, and the things that the creators have been saying after the show, we have some flashbacks to do. So we might not have lost that. We might use the entire deer of Ellie and Dina's relationship by the time we're through with it. But I do really appreciate, yeah, the Caitlin Dever performance, to go back to what you were saying.
She's so good. You know,
reading some behind the scenes info, this was like her first thing that she shot, followed later by the crosses that we saw, her scene at the crosses that we saw in episode one. But all of it, her shooting was rearranged because her mother passed away, and she had to go deal with that and then come back and work at this job. And just the amount of, I don't know, the psychological stress it takes to do this and sort of like keep it together. I think she was incredibly effective. And I like Caitlin Dever. I think not only have I liked her in previous things, but that alien abduction movie that had like zero dialogue made me look at her variance in, as you would call, face acting, Neil, expression, dramatic expression, so good that when she does that moment where Dina yells up at Joel in this episode after he's just saved her from the horde, that is like, oh shit, Joel, she immediately reaches for her gun, but then she like has to like process some more things, and she has to like scheme to get back to the cabin ultimately. But the amount of like different ways I can see the gears turn, it means that Caitlin Dever is at least expressing exactly what I want from the character at that point, which is all you can ask for an actor to do, ultimately.
Yeah.
But we'll swing back to that. Let's go back to what you were saying about Tommy, the big siege of Jackson here is not something that happens in the game, is my understanding, correct?
Right.
And is very sort of like HBO coded. I don't know if we could ever separate this show from Game of Thrones, Neil. Like, not only does it have two of our beloved crushed characters from Game of Thrones as its lead, but now we got ice zombies again.
They're never going to be able to separate this show from Thrones now that they've done Pedro Pascal head drama.
Yes, absolutely. but I did like this sort of placement as a escalation, but also sort of a dramatic mirror to what Abby's effect has on the story. So her sort of sliding down that hill not only brings her closer to Joel and what she's going to do to kick off sort of Ellie's, I don't know, I assuming she lives, when I saw the previously on, I'm going to assume she lives, whatever Ellie's story is going to be going forward, but does also like dramatically kick off an assault against Jackson, which they live through in theory, but do have to execute a very costly plan, both in terms of resources they don't have and in terms of the people. What did you make of the siege of Jackson? You and I have spent a lot of time looking at how to make action sequences with zombies in the snow. How did the Seeds of Jackson weigh up to some of the other sequences you've seen?
I mean, I liked it on a number of levels. On a narrative level, I really think it's a very clever adaptation choice for a very specific reason, because think about the headspace that some of our main characters are going to be in when we meet them again here in the next episode. I'm speaking of Ellie, Tommy, Dina, maybe even Jesse in this regard. They're going to be very angry about what happened to Joel, right? They're going to be obviously very affected by what happened in Jackson. And there's going to be a desire to get some vengeance, right? This show is not subtle about being about cycles of violence, right? We are experiencing Joel just experienced the end result or the consequences of his own violence that he did at the end of season one. So there's going to be a desire to go and find Abby and her people, but that's going to maybe come in conflict with, I would imagine, Maria and the rest of the town council needing to rebuild and refortify Jackson after it has been not completely decimated, but pretty wrecked by this situation. And I think that's a really interesting narrative space for Jackson to be in. And that's going to be an interesting conversation for all of these characters to go through in probably in this next episode. Like, we want to get revenge, but we need to like rebuild the wall, literally. Right. So I think that's going to be really interesting, and it's going to add a layer of complexity to some of the decisions that they're going to have to make. So I like that. As far as the battle, I love that it's set in the daytime. I love that they shot a lot of it on a real mountain in a real snowstorm. Like, it, a lot of it felt very tactile. And, you know, there's plenty of digital effects, right?
Yes.
In expanding, like, the size of the infected horde, and obviously the explosions. Although some of those explosions, I mean, they look composited, but really cool. Really, some good blowing stuff up. We love to see it. We love some good explosions. But, you know, a lot of great practical effects. Again, Barry Gower and the practical effects team were really doing it up. I was watching the Inside the Episode, and they were talking about how they very specifically made some of these infected look like they were sort of like frostbitten. Mushroom.
Cool. Yeah, like a
infected.
Darker.
Yeah, it just sort of gave it a very cool look. And, you know, it looked like there were a lot of practical stunt performers on set for this. And I just think that, you know, if you're making this kind of show, right, big budget, HBO, Sunday night, and you're trying to live up to that legacy of a Game of Thrones, you got to put all the money on screen. And this feels like this show coming out swinging in the second episode of its second season and saying, not only did we get a bigger budget from the Warner Brothers Discovery Overlords this year, but we are putting that money on screen and we're going to show it to you. So I think it's a really good battle sequence. It's exciting on a number of levels, and it gives me hope that over the next, five episodes left in the season, we might see maybe one more big one at least.
Yeah.
You know, who knows? I mean, this one, as someone who's played the game, didn't know was coming. So I know that, you know, there are a couple opportunities from the game to do some big sequences, but they might surprise us as well. And yeah, I thought, you know, Mark Millad pulled it off. It's tricky because they had to pull off the balance between showing us this big action sequence and then obviously hitting the dramatic notes and what's happening up the mountain. And I think they found it, and it's a really, really well executed episode.
Yeah, definitely. There's some, I think, yeah, like you're saying, updates to how they actually did the zombies. My understanding is the bloater this time was completely CG and animated. But the season one, episode one was, or the season one Bloater was also fully digital, but they did have a guy in costume on set doing it. They just replaced his performance.
And notably, that was a night. He was at night. So there's, you know, it's a little bit easier to sort of cover up the rough edges of.
Well, this one has some layers.
This guy is like in the sunlight all alone.
Getting blasted with fire.
It's that's not an easy effect to pull off. And I thought it looked awesome.
It looked pretty great. And then also like the snow, the amount of particles that were going on between the fire hitting him, the snow hitting him, and him sort of like burning slash puffing out some cordyceps every once in a while is a great effect. Greatly enjoyed that. What do I need to, I was watching this with my partner Java, and when Maria let the dogs out, she was like, oh no, are they gonna hurt the dogs? And I'm like, I mean, the dogs are fine. This is a human-based spore disease, so I'm actually, this is the smartest thing that I've seen them do. Did they have attack dogs for cordyceps in the game?
All right, this, I really wanted to talk about this because, as you know, this is a very important thing in the games to me, because we've talked about this multiple times. The games, both games, are not kind to man's best friend, especially because there's a lot of situations where you as the player are like, have dogs sicked on you, and there's no good way to get rid of them
non-violently, dismiss them.
Yeah, so you end up having to kill some dogs, and they're viciously coming at you, and you know, you're like playing as Ellie and all you have is like a hammer, and it's terrible and I hate it. So to me, when Maria goes down and she's opening the door and I hear the dogs, I'm like, oh hell yes, here comes a heroic moment for the dogs, and they gave it to me. To me, this is like dog redemption for this entire franchise. And I thought it was awesome because, yeah, the dogs basically turn the tide of what's going on Main Street. And yeah, they're vicious, and they have, you know, they teased it in the opening conversation when the Abby's crew is talking about like what they have down there. Like after they sort of scouted out Jackson, they're like, oh, they also have dogs. And I love that they came back and they helped put down the infect. I don't know. They didn't show any of the dogs getting hurt. I assume the dogs had a 100% hit rate on the infected and cleared the board because they looked like they were doing really well. And so for me, this was a triumphant moment. I was rooting for the dogs the entire way. And it felt like, you know, one of those like Easter egg sort of meta commentaries on the game. It was just as impactful to me as a video game player as like when Ellie picked up the bong gas mask in the scene with Jesse, because that's also directly from the game. But this was significantly more triumphant, and hopefully this is not like a, you know, an olive branch that they're giving the audience to sate us for terrible things happening to dogs later, but we'll see.
I mean, you've also given this Last of Us trauma to me just vicariously by talking about the dogs. Yeah. I remember you reviewing the game initially when it came out and being like, so there's this thing about dogs, we got to talk about it. And that was like a big narrative turning point for you. But
it was very like traumatic.
Like with the Abby expansion here, I think because they don't have to make you live through it, I think you might be spared it. And I hope that for all of us. There isn't a great reason, I don't think, to not make it people on people violence, or dog on cordyceps violence, or cordyceps on people violence. You know, there's, you got a triangle where people don't have to hurt the dogs. That's right. What I think is possible on television.
We'll see. I mean, this show is just as brutal so far as the games have been up to this point. So I wouldn't put it past them. But I'm hopeful that Craig Mazin is going to spare us this time around.
So I do want to say that I appreciate the storytelling trope of sort of focusing in on sort of like Tommy and Maria as the horde taking over the town gets more and more intense. Like, mm-hmm. usually if you're doing that type of sequence, you're sort of cross-cutting between multiple characters, but sort of making the bloater, I don't know how much I believe that the bloater is going to look at a sniper and be like, you, I'm going to walk until I get you. But
he doesn't even like Tommy, have eyes as far as we can tell, but it's, right? It's fine.
For Tommy to then draw its attention and make, you know, sort of like this one-on-one climax, a climax for the whole fight, and then leave the rest up to dogs, I think is a very smart storytelling decision in order to keep this like as efficient as possible. Because ultimately, I think another great thing about the Siege of Jackson, not only is it like fun to watch and the town gets a win while also shifting the focus off of what Ellie's going to want to do to just, we should keep everybody alive. But I like how present they're keeping the zombie threat. I like this new idea that underneath a pile of frozen zombies could be 1,000 other zombies. Mm-hmm. Because cool. it keeps them present. Like, this story right now could become human on human in the post-apocalypse if it wanted to. Like, I have that conflict working for me now. But this sort of keeps, you know, the presence there. And last episode, we got a new type with the stalker. So I like how the threat is present, even though it's not the type of experience like a video game where we have to fight one of these every time we go somewhere. So far, so good on the not just being a show about violence between humans, but sure. also including the cordyceps there every once in a while.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if we're going to judge the tactics of the people of Jackson, they seem to be doing pretty well with what they had. Although, Dave, I will ask this. Do you think there should have been a trench of some kind?
I was very impressed with, at least in terms of when we usually see zombie hordes, they're usually pretty coordinated. These guys are falling all over each other every 5 feet. so I do think a trench would have been a good idea. Maybe that's how they can adapt in the future. Mm-hmm. But I will say about this is almost every tactic they used would have been as effective against raiders as against the cordyceps. And maybe that's what ultimately what they're doing is they're planning for both. And maybe humans would be too smart for a trench, or, you know, the trench would have to be too deep. Who knows?
Yeah, I guess I'm a little disappointed because it's been 5 years that Ellie and Joel have been there, that they did not at any point impart some of Bill's wisdom on the people of Jackson. And like, mm-hmm. we didn't get any trenches. There's no spiked pits. Then again, I mean, you don't want like the citizens of Jackson falling into spiked pits randomly. Right. So, you know, I could see the debate, but it would have helped if you had some spiked pits or some trenches. I'm just saying.
Well, luckily, Neil, as this show keeps reminding us by sort of allowing us to see where characters at as opposed to where we left them, or in Jackson's case, how much they were able to develop versus where we left them, we have a 5-year gap, and we're going to have to fill in that 5-year gap. Specifically, this episode, two things made me think about that. Mm-hmm. One, Ellie wants to go on patrol with Joel, even though the last time I saw them, they were very mad at each other. So mm-hmm. I suspect something else happened because the guitar that he was playing on the porch is back in her room.
Yeah. Well, and notably, that's the guitar that he's like, I'm going to put new strings on it. And he took it from her, right? Mm-hmm. In the first episode. So her having the guitar back already leads me to believe that they had at least one more interaction after the New Year's events. So, you know, I think that there's plenty of opportunity there. And I think Craig Mazin has said this openly in a couple of his interviews that, you know, the show will deploy similar to the way the game, I mentioned at the top, there's a lot of nonlinear storytelling, and that includes a lot of flashbacks to Joel and Ellie and their relationship over the last 5 years. So it's like, don't worry, we're going to get our money's worth of Pedro Pascal in this season. I'm hopeful. I don't think this is true. This feels like the kind of event on a TV show that would hopefully make people more interested in keeping going with the TV show. But, you know, Pedro's big presence. So if anybody's thinking about quitting The Last of Us, I would encourage them not to, because they're still, he's, you know, still going to be around, and the presence of Joel exists even after his death. And it's funny because this is, I've seen a lot of folks using, again, to use Game of Thrones parlance, the Red Wedding comparison. It's like, this is the Red Wedding of The Last of Us. And I disagree with that, because the Red Wedding was something that kind of came out of nowhere for people who didn't know it was coming. And like, we even the audience didn't know that was coming, right? We had no idea that Walder Frey was like making that plot. This one, we obviously knew what Abby's intentions were. This to me is more like the Ned Stark event in the first season of Thrones, where it's like, this is the foundational element that starts the story from here on out. And it continues to reverberate out into everything else that happens for the rest of the story. And I think that includes people's memories of Joel and how people react to Joel's death. So, you know, we don't have to look much further than the trailers that we have for this season already that have way more footage of Joel than what we've seen so far.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot to come. Ultimately, like, we'll see how they decide to play it for season three, which we know not a lot about. But this is our new status quo in a way that, like, this is like the halfway point of the story that we understand. Mm-hmm. Maybe is a good way to think about it. So it's not so much, an ending as a climax. We knew about the second the first season started, and know about some other stuff too, because there's a video game, and you know what, they're sticking real close to that video game.
Yep.
Sometimes even copying whole sequences. Neil, I was looking back at the death sequence once again, terrifying. Mm-hmm. But after listening to the official Last of Us podcast, where they characterize that last scene as Ellie thinks she's also dying, cause she's been kicked in the ribs pretty severely and kind of drags herself over to dead Joel to lie there and maybe die with him. And the first couple of times I rewatched it, just tragic. About the third time I was like, I came across the thing that you alluded to earlier. Pedro Pascal and head trauma makeup really go hand in hand on HBO.
Yeah.
And it made me think of like my favorite crushed heads. And then it made me think very specifically as I started to list my favorite crushed heads, if it's just favorite crushed heads of the 21st century, because there's a lot of exploding heads back in the day. From like your Scanners to your, you know, Maniac to like your classic, you know, Tom Savini exploding head.
Right. The 80s and 90s, they love to just do a practical effect, basically mannequin head and blow it up.
Right. And then somewhere around like Jared Leto's character Angel Face in Fight Club, we started getting really good at the just like traumatically break somebody's face on camera. They're after David Fincher's Fight Club. I'll just pin it to that. I'm sure there's better film history. Please let me know. stormofspoilers@gmail.com. I was just thinking about some of the most memorable, aka best head crushings of the 21st century. Are there any that stand out to you? And I want to see if they made my list.
I mean, obviously the other one that Pedro Pascal is involved in, which
Game
is
Game of Thrones,
Prince
Oberyn popping
Martell.
Like a grape.
And I found it really interesting as I was watching the inside of the episode. There's an interview with Pedro where he's talking about shocking moments in fiction. And he's like, you know, sometimes you're reading a book and you throw the book across the room because something is so shocking because you're so invested. And I was like, holy shit, that's me. I did that twice reading those damn Game of Thrones books, The Red Wedding, and when Oberyn dies. I was like, your character did that to me in a book. I had a dent that I had to pay out of my security deposit in my old apartment from where I threw the book.
From a book dent.
George R. R. Martin did that. So yeah, I think that's probably my big one.
I came up with two television ones.
Okay, hit me with your TV ones.
Because recently Daredevil Born Again came around, I do think Kingpin smashing a guy's head in the door from Daredevil season one was a big, like, hey, we're here, we're gonna do head crushings on Netflix.
I mean, not to spoil too much, but there's a similar one in Daredevil season two. It was interesting.
There are Kingpin's doing some horrible stuff to people's
heads. It's sort of his move. Sure.
Yeah, I believe. Not to spoil too much of Daredevil Born Again, but also does it in Daredevil Born Again. There was Old Man versus the Mallet in Midsummer. Oh, sorry. I said I was going to do the TV one first. Twin Peaks, The Return, Episode 8. If I say Got a Light, what sort of head crushing do you picture?
Yep. Okay.
So much blood, single-handed head crushing. In Midsummer, The Old Man versus the Mallet. I was looking up best prop heads in horror movies and came across a whole article with very graphic pictures of how the Midsummer practical effect was done. And then probably the like two that stuck out, one for being thrilling and one for being traumatizing, was the bear Jew sequence from Inglourious Basterds.
Sure.
I remember seeing that in theaters and being like, I mean, I like that one. I'm an Indiana Jones type Nazi violence person. If it's against a Nazi, I'm kind of in favor of it.
I mean, I approve of it. It's just violent.
Oh, yeah. And then the other one that was super violent and from a movie that has scarred me for life was, do you remember the fire extinguisher death in Irreversible? Gasper Noyes, Irreversible.
Yeah.
That is, that's tough. That's some head trauma.
That's a tough one. I have a couple.
Yeah, go for it.
There is the one that kind of happens off screen in Drive, the Ryan Gosling movie, 2011, yes. In the elevator. That one's gnarly. And then I think maybe the most iconic one that speaking of Nazis, will never, ever want to revisit, American History X.
Oh, yeah.
Where he makes the dude bite the curb.
The curb stomping that scene, is, yes.
Absolutely horrific. And also, I think mostly happens off screen, but just the idea of what happens to that dude's face is extremely gnarly. So, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
If we did the 20th century, there would be like five Robert De Niro entries if we were counting like off-screen beatings. Because basically, like in every Martin Scorsese movie, Robert De Niro kicks somebody in the head. Sure. It's very interesting. But yeah, what a time to be alive and watch people go through a simulated head trauma.
Oh, there's one in Breaking Bad too. The ATM machine.
Oh, you're right.
The ATM machine falls on the drug addict's head. Oh god.
Yeah.
Oh man. Prestige TV really knows how to do head trauma. It's so rough.
Oh yeah. We're talking about human head trauma too. I imagine if we expanded it to like, surely there's other zombie prestige television series that have done lots of head trauma stuff.
Yeah, and this one I will say the prosthetic that they made, again, Barry Gower and his team did an incredible job making Pedro's face look really, really messed up. I thought that, again, another adaptation choice is in the game, she just beats him with the golf club all the way. But in this, the golf club breaks and she ends up stabbing him, which I think is even more horrific than just hitting him with the end of it. So somehow they made it even worse.
Yeah, the implication is that it breaks and then she just keeps punching him, because you do see that for like a little bit. So it's just like it's a lot.
She's very violent, that Abby. She was very angry about what Joel did.
Well, I have a feeling that we are being prepped to excuse some future bad behavior because we really felt that Abby was crossing the line here. Or maybe I was wrong when I kept saying that this is a show that is about you know, cycles of violence and retribution. Maybe it is actually about using violence as an expression of love, whether that be as like remembrance or that you like justifiable love. Like, I did love that person because of how badly I'm going to hurt you.
Oh, interesting.
Sort of like a past sort of expression.
Okay.
Grief and love make violence, question? Let's find out.
Sure.
With The Last of Us.
I have a feeling that's one way Ellie will justify what she wants to do here.
Well, Neil, I do want to talk about one more thing before we head out of the calm, which is the other thing that implies, I think, flashback in this episode, is we learn from Jesse that he and Eugene, not only was Eugene a Firefly, which we learned from his little pendant, but we learned from Jesse that he was had been in the military and has been growing pot, and we get a sort of callback to what Gail said earlier, that he had to be killed and that Joel did it. So we're sort of on a Eugene watch / theory corner. Having to put him down, as it is put in this episode, sounds a little bit more like he was infected to me.
Yeah.
Which but then when you were talking about like, why don't they have pits? I'm like, oh, what if they did have pits and Eugene got too high and fell in the pit and they had to put him out of his misery? So
I guess that is the other option. You know, the way Jesse says this, I'm like, yeah, this sounds like he got bit and Joel had to kill him. Right. Similar to what we see at the end of this episode with the guy holding up his bite and handing the gun to the person.
Yeah.
Like, we just see them shoot him as the camera pans away, which is just horrifying. But also, you know, makes sense, I guess.
It's a zombie apocalypse.
So I feel like I'm sticking to that as my like solid gene theory for now. But yeah, if he had an injury that they knew was sort of, he wasn't going to come back from, right? That maybe he had to, Joel had to just, Kind of like if you know, something terrible happens to a horse and they're just like, well, we can't fix it, so we gotta do the thing. That's rare with humans. You know, we can fix a lot of stuff with humans, even in this apocalyptic scenario where the medical situation isn't great. Jackson seems to have plenty of resources. I assume there's at least one doctor.
Well, I mean, we assume that, and we also see that who's running the radio, Anna or something. Mm-hmm. She is in a wheelchair.
Right.
So, but like, what if someone falls and gets paralyzed? Like, do you have the resources for that? You know,
it's
like
true. What kind of healthcare system does Jackson have?
Yeah. I can't wait to see how it's deployed, because it could also be deployed as I was saying, as like a break from human on human violence, to remember that there was at one point an infection. But yeah, we're going to maybe get to spend some more time with Joel just in flashback. Sad he's going to have to put somebody down, but it does seem like we're going to see some of that, according to, they brought it up twice.
Yep.
And in the rules of television, that means we're probably going to see it.
Yep.
Neil, anything else we need to talk about before we move into the storm?
Before we move on to talking about spoilery stuff, great performances all around. One more sort of Easter egg. She's still alive in the show, so we're going to talk about her again. But Tati Gabriel, who plays Nora, she's the bald one in Abby's crew. She is the star of the protagonist of Naughty Dog's next game called Intergalactic, which there's a trailer for, which I thought was just sort of a cool thing. So like, Naughty Dog is the studio that made The Last of Us. So that their next game is Intergalactic, and she is the, she plays the protagonist, which I thought was, yeah, that's pretty cool. They put her in the show too.
And while we're Easter egging, fans of the game will know this, but the titular song Through the Valley is sung by Ashley Johnson,
who
is,
that's a good one as well,
the voice of Ellie. It was used to like premiere, my understanding is, The Last of Us Part 2 via trailer. So a lot of people are aware of this version. But I would like to thank the wonderful subtitlers at HBO for
I saw that.
Through the Valley by Ashley Johnson coming up and me being like, ooh, and getting to write that down.
Great stuff. But yeah, I mean, I think this being such a pivotal moment, the scene where Joel dies, the performances, the three performances really had to come through, right? Pedro's performance as Joel, especially in the parts leading up to, not necessarily the part where he's like laying there dying. That's just him sort of laying there in prosthetics. But I thought he was really great in sort of the beginning of that scene where he's sort of defiant in the face of Abby's monologue.
Obviously, well, but gives a little nod too when she's like, some things, yeah, you know, are just wrong.
He's defiant, but he's also sort of, again, resigned to it. He understands very, very well what's happening. Caitlin Dever, excellent, the way she turns it on and flips on a more sinister switch and turns, amps up the rage as it goes along, right? Like, then by the time we get to the shots where she's just pummeling him with her fists, I'm like, all right, this is Abby. Like, she's coming out. And then I thought that Bella Ramsey just kills it. I mean, there isn't a ton of stuff for Ellie in this sequence, right? She shows up very much at the end, but it's a huge emotional moment with her just pleading with them not to do this, and her thinking that this is the end for both of them, essentially. And I thought that they did just a fantastic job. And I think that it, you know, again, this is the start of a relationship between Abby and Ellie that is going to, the rest of the season sort of hinges on it. And it's going to be, I'm very excited, right? Like, we talked last week about watching Pedro's performance and the showrunners probably feeling very validated that they chose the right person. This is the kind of scene for these two other performers where it's like, okay, we chose the right people for this, you know. Mm-hmm. Caitlin and Bella are the right ones, and this is going to go well from here on out, and we'll see. I'm excited.
It's going to go well in that it makes for good television.
Oh, yeah.
I doubt that it's going to go well for most of our characters.
Terrible shit's going to happen.
We all talk about that a little bit in the storm. If you are staying spoiler free, now's your time to hop off. We will see you next Wednesday to discuss episode 3. But for the rest of you, let's head in to the storm.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
First storm and the last.
Neil, mm-hmm. It looks like from the episode 3 teaser that when Ellie wakes up, she's sort of unaware of what happened. She has like a tube coming out of her, and she seems very shocked. Do you think that's where we pick up? We just pick up immediately from Ellie's POV and we're off to the races?
Yeah, maybe. Deeply, deeply traumatized Ellie. I mean, that's pretty much where the game picks up. I mean, what's different, and one of the things I kind of like, is that the show gives us more space, right? The scene ends in the game with Ellie being, you're playing as Ellie and you get knocked out and you get woken up by Dina, you know, later when Dina finds Ellie and Tommy and Joel's body. And that's sort of, you sort of kicks off this next portion where they're like back in Jackson deciding what to do. So I think it'll be very interesting. She seems like she's in a state of shock, right, when we see them going back on the horse. So I think that we'll have a little bit of that. We'll have her being in shock. There's the shot of her walking into Joel's house, which I think is very important. There's that sequence is in the game where she's like going through some of his personal effects and you know, picking up some of his stuff and making decisions about what to do next and gathering information. We also see Dina telling her that she knows Abby's name and she knows at least what the group is called, and they figure out that they're in Seattle and they're like, we got to go get them. And this is where we will hopefully learn next week what they're going to do with Tommy.
Yeah.
Which is very fascinating, because in the game, Tommy is like, he convinces Ellie to hold out for one. Ellie's ready to go. Ellie's ready to leave for Seattle. Dina's ready to go with her. They're going to go. They're going to find Abby's people and kill them all. Tommy's like, give me one more day to convince Maria to give us some people, like to give us a crew to take with us. And overnight, Tommy takes off on his own and without anybody else. And so I think last week I was talking about how I'm like, maybe the fact that he has a kid will lead to Tommy staying. I'm almost convinced that that might not be the case. Like, I'm almost flipped back on that one, especially given the state of Jackson and given the way that Tommy leaving sort of affects the plot down the road. Like, it really causes a huge rift in his marriage with Maria that he just takes off after Joel's killer.
Right.
And I think that it'll make it even worse if he takes off now, right when they're about to have to like rebuild Jackson. So I think that Tommy's going to do what Tommy's going to do. He's going to run off to Seattle as well. And then Ellie and Dina are going to have to take off after him. But we're going to have a little space, I would imagine, in this next episode where they're going to have a couple conversations about it.
Yeah, because right now, Tommy doesn't, like, because he's there in the game, he knows what he's hunting. Now Dina would have to tell him.
Sure. Somebody's gonna have to explain to Tommy what happened out in that lodge.
Right. Because he could maybe go to the lodge, but unless they've left like a really hasty trail, like even if he does go out, he doesn't know where he's going. Mm-hmm. So there has to be some conversations in there or a change. Definitely to figure that out. Neil, what are your thoughts given how they've restructured sort of the Dina, Tommy, / more information about Abby of it all? What are the adaptations leading you to believe was actually going to happen this season?
Well, it's actually kind of tough to read, because as I was playing through more of the game, I got through a pretty good portion of it this week on my stream, and a pretty significant portion of Ellie's story, right? Because the way the game is structured, you pick up and you play as Ellie for a while, right? And Abby goes away, and you're out there, you're searching for Tommy, you're searching for Abby's people, you're in Seattle, you're sort of investigating the wolves, the WLF, and you're sort of getting the lay of the land of Seattle, which is sort of mysteriously, there's not a lot of people around and there aren't a ton of infected, but you know, you're running into infected here and there. And you're spending a lot of time with Dina, and the big sort of turning point of the game narratively is when Ellie eventually does encounter Abby. And like, and it's, you know, she kind of gets through all of Abby's people, and then she encounters Abby. And right at the moment where they're about to like have their, like, you know, basically one of them is about to shoot the other one, that's when, right, the game cuts and is like, flashback, now you're Abby. And you're going to experience these same day, you know, couple of days in Seattle from Abby's perspective to show you what she was doing this entire time. And that's the moment in the game where I was like, oh, fuck you, naughty dog. Like, no way you're going to bring me to this moment where I've been stewing about Abby, the villain of this story, according to me. And no way you're going to reorient my feelings about this character. And you know, the fact that they successfully do that is part of why I think it's a brilliant game. But I think that the way that that's structured is very tough to read as far as how they would split that into two seasons, right? Because they can't have Abby go away for the rest of this season. I don't think. I mean, I guess they could. They could have no more Caitlin Dever until the finale, maybe. But what leads me to believe that that's not true is I went back and I watched the Weeks Ahead trailer, and there's a lot of stuff with the Scars, the bald-headed religious folks that they encounter in Seattle. And the Scars are this sort of cult-ish religious group that are having sort of a conflict with the WLF. And most of Abby's story is about engaging with the Scars and her feelings, the way her feelings change about the WLF and her gaining some, you know, maybe some empathy for these Scars that they're fighting against. And there's not a lot of Ellie's story that comes into contact with the Scars. Like it's very sort of tangential to what she's doing. She's looking for Tommy. She's looking for Ellie's people. She sort of sees the result of this conflict. So I think given the amount of Scars stuff that's in the trailer, I don't think they're going to leave the Abby stuff out. So maybe it's not going to be as cut and dry as like we follow Ellie and then we hard cut and we have to see all the Abby stuff. Maybe they're just going to mix and match and we'll see sort of both storylines going as we get there, because that also means that like we wouldn't meet Jeffrey Wright's character until like the finale, which I don't think doesn't seem right to me just from a TV standpoint. Why would you put him in the trailer? And
well, maybe the question to ask from a TV standpoint is if you don't have that sudden because the switch in perspective is only really cool on the back half of the switch. They need to sustain interest in the show in between seasons. So what would the season two cliffhanger be in order to make you come back in season three?
I mean, well, and that's the thing. Like if they were to stick to the way the game works, then they would kind of have to end season two on this insane cliffhanger, which is like Ellie's spends the rest of the season searching for Abby. They finally encounter each other, and then it's like one of them standing there pointing the gun at the other one, cut to black. That's the season. And I think that's a very frustrating place to end a season of television and then make your audience wait. I think that people would be in revolt not knowing what happens after that, especially because if they were to structure it like that, then you come back and like the beginning half of season three is just all about Abby. And I don't know if you can pull that off. Like that's too high a bar for a television show. So I think I still think that it could be this season could end with sort of the conflict between Abby and Ellie meeting. They ultimately meet in this theater. And it's a very kind of cool scene that involves Ellie and Abby, and Jesse's there and Tommy's there. And, you know, it's they've been searching for each other for days at this point all over Seattle. And Ellie has killed a lot of Abby's friends at this point. Abby's been through some shit. So I think that is potentially where they could end season two. The other concern I have game wise is there's not a whole lot of story after that. So they might have to pad things out in season three, because there is stuff to do after that, after they have this conflict, after they have this meeting, but it's not a lot. Like it doesn't feel to me like a whole season of television. So I'm still sort of struggling to see where it fits in. And I think it'll start to come into focus over the next couple of episodes once we see how much more of Abby's POV we get. Like how often are we going to check in with what's going on with Abby and her crew back in Seattle? Because I think the show's focus could shift almost entirely to Seattle, you know, especially if Tommy does like he does in the game, go looking for Joel's killers. Then that means we have two tracks of story that the show could be bouncing back and forth from. We have Ellie and Dina looking for Tommy, and we have Abby's crew and sort of what's happening to them simultaneously. So if the show's not going to do what the game does and give us one and then the other one afterwards, you know, in this knee-jerk flashback, then I think it'll feel more like a regular TV show where we're just watching two storylines happening next to each other. And I'm confident that they can figure it out, but I'm still having a little trouble sort of piecing together exactly how far into the game's story they're going to go. Because I guess in like real time, between now and when they eventually meet again, there's only like a couple of days worth of story. Like a lot of shit happens in Seattle in a couple of days, but you know, it's only a couple of days, so we'll see. And it's in the game, there's a lot of flash, there's several big flashbacks that I think we're going to get. We've seen in the trailer there's a shot of a T-Rex, like a science museum T-Rex. That's a very impactful Joel and Ellie flashback where they go to a museum that I think is the best scene, best non-action scene, I think, in either game, that they will probably adapt pretty faithfully. There's another one that involves them sort of out in Jackson going for guitar strings, and they sort of get ambushed by a bloater that I think they could probably do either this season or next season, that once again reinforces Joel kind of doubles down on his lie about the fireflies and the cure. So I think that's we're going to spend a lot of time there, but you know, most of the rest of it is Ellie and Dina kicking around Seattle, mostly having to kill a bunch of humans as the WLF is sort of hunting them. And I think we'll probably get some Shamblers.
What's a Shambler?
Shambler is a larger, I mean, yeah, if I were running this TV show, I would do a the Shambler would be my big trick at the end of the season, right? Because we've seen bloaters. And I was reminded of this as I was playing pretty early on in Seattle. You encounter a Shambler, which is slightly larger than a bloater, infected, that have these like more bulbous heads. And you have to shoot them more, but when they die, they expel spores. They like explode with spores, and they're sort of like these like corrosive spores. And so they're like really gnarly. And you even when you have like a mask on, you can't be like too close to them, otherwise it'll get you. So they're really horrific. And it's like this really scary thing that as Ellie and Dina are like trying to run away from and avoid the wolves, the WLF, they also like are like, holy shit, what are these things?
All right.
And it's so I think that could be a cool thing, like a cool trick and maybe a big effect later in the season. Yeah, I also, Dave, before I get too far into what might happen in season two, I wanted to update you on Shimmer.
Oh no, the horse. Okay,
we talked about Shimmer's importance last week, and I told you that Shimmer's gonna be around for a while. I was reminded in my playthrough, like 10 minutes into my stream this week, that something terrible happens to Shimmer pretty much right when they get to Seattle.
Oh, they're like, well, now that you're here, you can't have a horse.
Yeah, I mean,
that's OP.
Yeah, a horse is too easy to get around Seattle on a horse. And yeah, it's bad. So I'm worried that they'll probably adapt that pretty faithfully in the show. Poor Shimmer, but you know, Shimmer still beats Joel as far as living longer, I guess. But I thought it was very funny because last week I was so confident, like, oh yeah, Shimmer will be around for a little while. I don't think anything bad happens till later, because I thought it happened like much later in the game, but no, it's like right away. So
they should give him the Bill the Pony Lord of the Rings treatment, which is they just get there and they're like, he'll find his way home. Yeah. And we just he's fine.
Exactly. Yeah, so I'm sorry. I misled you last week in the storm, but
boo.
It's tough.
But if we have a never-ending story moment on this show this season, I'm going to be so mad at you.
Listen, if they do it the same way they do it in the game, it happens very quickly for Shimmer. It's brutal, but it happens quickly. And it's also like in the middle of a bunch of other terrible stuff happening, and like Ellie and Dina kind of on the run from the wolves. So we don't even really we'll have time to like process what's going on. It'll just be like, oh no, Shimmer. And then we're like on to something else. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. The show could do a deeply manipulative thing where, you know, in the next episode, we see them like traveling to Seattle and they have like, you know, some touching moments with Shimmer, and then something very bad happens. I don't know. We'll see. So
I think there's a way that they could structure, I think, the rest of the season that just what we're getting to is from Righteous Revenge with Ellie to like she beats somebody to death for the first time, which sure. I watched the just clips of Abby's friends dying in the video game edited together.
Oh yeah.
Still took like 30 minutes, but I just watched it all just to remind myself where those took place in the story. And there's that bald woman you were shouting out earlier.
Nora. Yeah.
When she like, I think is around the same time as the Shambler, because she's definitely is like, Ellie, you're breathing in spores, and Ellie doesn't give a shit. And she's like, where's Abby? And Nora's like, I'm not gonna give up my friend. And so Abby just starts beating her and the game cuts away. Like, you cut from that to the porch conversation. That's the end of a season for me. Just like
that
she became
be yep.
she death. Became Abby by the end of the season.
Ellie killing Nora could be the end of the season. I think there's a really tough one where she kills Owen and the
Mel
and Mel in the aquarium.
But Ashley Birch in the game.
But again, that's one where it takes place again, kind of late in story wise in the game.
Right.
And I feel like I'm really curious for next week's episode. I feel like it'll give us a lot better sense of the pacing, because so far they're kind of on the same pacing as the video game, as the second game right now, right? This we're 2 hours in. We've seen Joel die. That's about where we were in the game, 2 hours in. But you know, the game is a 20-hour experience, and the way it's split is very different than I think what you would want to split up a TV show. I don't think you want to have an Ellie season and then an Abby season, right? I think you can't, I just don't think you can do that. I don't think you can break it up like that. So I think maybe it'll just be them sort of weaving it all together. And yeah, maybe it's like we sort of end kind of halfway through Ellie's journey in Seattle with one of the big kills of Abby's people, and maybe Ellie and Abby don't meet again this season, which I think is, you know, it's a little bit tougher to pull off as far as keeping the audience engaged in that relationship, right, between Ellie mm-hmm. and Abby, because it's extremely important for the end game of the story. But, you know, I think it's entirely possible for them to do it, especially if they're showing us the other side of Abby's story, because I think you could get to a point if you're showing us Abby's story alongside Ellie's story, where by the end of the season, we feel bad about Ellie and we feel a little bit better about Abby. And that would be kind of a weird place to be for the audience, but kind of interesting, right? Like we
kind of there's like
already starting to flip the dynamic.
Sometime in season three, we have some sort of perspective switch where we see Ellie hunting Abby and we're terrified by it.
Yeah.
That's like the goal. So I would assume that if you like, I do agree it's a lot to pack into one season. I think the fact that they front loaded Abby as much as they did this season with like just enough so we understand where she's coming from, they could give us a little bit more about just what the lay of the land is through like natural flashback in Seattle and not have to necessarily get to building Abby up as like the thing. But I do like the idea that if you build Ellie up to be sort of like the villain, the sort of perspective switch where we get one sequence where it's just like, oh my God, Ellie's terrifying.
Sure. Or sort of Ellie becomes the person that we see Abby as in this episode that we just watched, right?
Yeah. In the game, there's this thing where Tommy interrogates people by making them write one thing down while he like beats the shit out of the other person if they don't match. And like, Ellie adapting that, she adapts that, I think, at like the Mel Owen kill. But like, that's like another thing where it's just like, that's a sign that she has become the brutality.
Sure.
I think we just have to end season two with her becoming the Walter White version of herself, the brutal version of herself.
Yeah. Oh, well, and they both got it from Joel. Remember, Joel did that in the first season when he was looking
for
Ellie?
Yeah, that's true.
So yeah, I think that that'll be, if the show can pull it off, that'll be its trick, is by the end of the season making us sort of uneasy about Ellie. And if they can really do it, already starting to make us feel better about Abby. It just, I guess it depends on how much of the Scars storyline we're going to get. I was trying to find out if they had cast, you know, there's two very important Scars characters that Abby sort of encounters, Lev and Yara. Lev is this little kid, and Yara is Lev's sister. And they're sort of key to unlocking Abby's sort of change in perspective, let's call it. And I don't think that they've announced the casting. I saw some like rumors about casting, but there's been nothing official on those two. But then again, in the trailer, there's several sequences where I'm like, that could be a Lev and Yara scene. But you know, maybe they'll hold that. But again, that's like a huge part of Abby's story. Then again, if they wanted to sort of piece it together, they could sort of end. There's this conflict, right? I was talking about one potential big battle sequence, right? Left in the season. There's this sort of big invasion where the wolves go after the Seraphites island. And it's like, it's a moment where Abby has a crisis of conscience. That was the phrase I was looking for. And she sort of escapes with Lev and Yara. And I think that could be a climactic moment for the end of the season. I just don't know exactly how you would line that up with what's going on with Ellie at the time.
I think you could have an Abby cliffhanger at the end of episode 3 this season. Have episode 4 be a flashback episode and then just come back and tell the Ellie story. And I think the audience would let Abby go if they needed to.
Sure.
But the question is, yes, what does that leave for Ellie in season 3? Because you just don't want to abandon her. That seems weird.
Similar to the fact that you don't want to abandon Abby for the rest of this season necessarily. You don't want to spend, you know, the first half of season 3 not doing anything with Ellie. I don't think you could do that with a TV show. Whereas like with the game, you know, it's very frustrating initially when the game does it because of the moment they choose to switch the POV, but you as the player can just keep going, right? And you can push through Abby's story. And
but I do think there's, it's not the same value as you go with the game, but there is some value in splitting the season in that season three. You know, all the reaction podcasts like us will be like, and here we're seeing Abby's side of what Ellie did in season two.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like there is a way to do that. It just feels weird because you would have to sort of let Ellie not be a featured character for the majority of season three.
Yeah.
Which odd, but maybe that's it. Maybe we really have to just focus on Ellie and Dina and Jesse and Tommy for the rest of the season. Do you think there's any other characters that are going to take on a more important, let's say for instance, Tommy goes out, comes back, and that's the difference of the game, is he comes back because his kid's there, because he has to rebuild Jackson because he doesn't have enough energy. He might go out and, you know, like maybe cause a whole bunch of the same drama, but maybe doesn't do the same things. I don't know. That's so weird.
Yeah.
What character would you swap in if that happened?
I mean, this is the thing I've been rethinking as I've gotten a little bit deeper into the game in my playthrough and started to remember kind of how this goes. Because it is kind of pivotal that Tommy is there for the confrontation in the theater. It's actually, to me, feels narratively important that Ellie, Dina, Jesse, and Tommy are all there.
Right.
So that means Tommy not only has to go to Seattle, but he has to be there the entire time that Ellie and Dina and Jesse are there. So I will be very confused, at least initially, if my initial guess was right and Tommy doesn't take off for Seattle, because, you know, maybe they turn that into like Jesse goes off, but I don't think Jesse has a good enough reason to go after Joel's killers. It really is like,
well,
Tommy,
Dina has a reason because she's there and Jesse has a reason to follow Dina.
Yeah, I mean, that's true, but I don't think either one of them would go off without Ellie. Tommy's the only one that where it makes sense that he would want to not only go after Joel's killers, but try to protect Ellie by leaving her in Jackson.
Right.
You know, and I think that's sort of why Tommy does what he does, is he's like,
would he protect Ellie by following her to Seattle? Maybe Tommy's not in front of them at all.
Yeah, I guess you could switch it that way. I mean, we'll see. I guess ultimately I'm just okay trusting Craig Mazin's decisions, right? Like most, I've approved of pretty much all of his adaptation choices so far. So if he wants to switch that up, I guess it could work. But, you know, the more I think about it, the more I'm like, I can't see how that scene in the theater between all these characters works the same way and has the same impact on like the end of the story, right? Because the way that scene plays out reverberates to the end game of the entire story, right? It deeply influences the way Tommy behaves in sort of the final act of the game. It deeply influences, traumatizes Ellie to a great extent, and bad shit happens to some of the other people involved. and I think that I can't see a way where they could remove one of those pieces from the board. Also, Lev is there. So like, we also need to get to the Lev and Yara story in order
right.
to.
But if that's a that season scene. Three problem, then Tommy doesn't have to leave really into during season two, because you could just write him a new way of getting there after Ellie in
season
three,
true.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, because Ellie still has plenty of reason to go to Seattle, and Dina will
rebuilding
absolutely go
Jackson
with her.
Rebuilding Jackson could be what's holding Tommy back until we need to deploy him, you know, in season three.
Sure.
But also by the fact he isn't there. But I do like that, you know, the switch that Dina's there to bring Dina and Ellie closer together. I do think since now they'll be traveling together, like as in the game, there's a cool cooler place for some makeout. I just don't know how fast we're going to cool down. How fast are we going to cool down from Ellie hitting the punching bag and making sketches of the wolf badges? So we're going to have to find out how that goes. But I do hope that we get a little bit more romance on that front, because I do care for Dina. But I'm going to have to really care for Dina for some of this to be gut punches in the future.
Yep. Yeah. And, I think I saw a lot of folks on my timeline who clearly were like game players who were a little sad that they left that scene out between Ellie and Dina, because it's a sweet scene. It's a tender moment. It also sort of adds to the guilt that Ellie carries later, because she's like, oh, well, I was making out with Dina in the weed den while Joel was getting captured by these people from Seattle. So we won't have that, but there's still plenty of trauma there for Ellie to have to deal with. I don't necessarily think it needed to be there. And again, I think that there will be more. There's still more time for these two to connect. I think there is also, and we'll see, this will be something I'll watch for next week as well, is how much they add to their journey between Jackson and Seattle. Because in the game, there's the immediate aftermath in Jackson, and then it just hard cuts to them like right outside Seattle. So we don't get anything in between the two. So I could see that being room for
Shimmer episode.
Adding a little bit of story. Spend some time with Shimmer. Who knows?
Shimmer crosses the Rockies.
But yeah.
Episode 4.
Yeah.
I'm into it. I think that's also a great place for a flashback episode. I'm really interested to see, because I really do enjoy episodes of television that make themselves thematically coherent through nonlinear storytelling. And I'm very excited to see to hear that is going to be what they keep up here in season 2, because that means after every episode, I could have a new idea of what the season's about.
Yeah.
And at the end, figure out I've been long conned.
Let me ask you two questions about the flashbacks. From a TV writing standpoint, because the game sort of waits, it lets you're in Seattle for a little while before you get flashbacks to Joel, and it sort of lets you stew in Ellie's anger. And then after you've gone through some like intense action moments, where Ellie and Dina are being pursued by the wolves and, you meet the shamblers and all that shit, then all of a sudden they have like a calm moment and Ellie starts having these memories of Joel. And they're sort of interspersed. So do you think it would be wise of them to do just a full on flashback episode? Do you think it would be wise of them to deploy that soon? Or would you wait? And would you sort of intersperse those as the season goes along so that you can kind of maximally tease out your remaining Pedro Pascal-ness?
I would like a double head fake. So I would say episode 3, zero flashbacks. Too soon.
Sure.
We don't need to.
Lots of emotions to process in the real world.
Yeah, we don't need that tool yet. You have our engine moving forward. I do think it would be smart to have an entire flashback episode because, A, they had such success with that in season 1, both with the DLC episode in the mall and the couple episodes, the entire flashback episode.
Yeah, the Bill and Frank episode.
Bill and Frank episode. So I think they did great use of that. I think the show has already established that language, and it would be good for us to start an episode and be like, oh good, Joel's gonna be here. So that's what I expect is the Eugene story, slash maybe some other things like we saw in this season on trailer. Gail talk about the meaning of the moth while like reading a book, it looked like in like a diner or something. So like a little bit more of the city, maybe set up some of the things that we're gonna see Tommy background repairing, that maybe Joel initially was making in that time period, since he was in charge of like building So there's a way to sort of like eventually use Joel and Tommy flashbacks and in Ellie flashbacks, depending. But I would say flashback episode leads into then deploying the flashbacks when you need them. I do think like this episode has to, or this season has to end around a Future Days flashback, right?
Yeah.
The song on maybe. The guitar, I would assume.
Yeah. Bring it all the way back around.
Well, it's like that's what the first episode title was, and but the song didn't show up in the episode.
That's
so
true.
It seems like that's calling your shot.
There are two deployments of that that I think they could use. There's one, obviously, a flashback of Joel singing it, and I think there's also a really great moment in Seattle where Ellie sings to Dina. Does she sing Future Days? No, she sings Take On Me. So I think, you know, I think they could use either one. But yeah, I don't know.
I just think if you use that as a title.
That feels kind of too long to wait for me. I feel like you use that sooner.
Oh, nice. You think we just start an episode? Actually, that's another way I would do is I just start an episode with the flashback. Not like full on Breaking Bad season 2 with cold opens all the way through, but you could use that occasionally. And I'd be into it. I really want it to be episode dependent. I don't love the idea of there being like a rule where it's like, we're only going to use it here. It's like, no, if it makes for the good episode, if you're doing an episode about, you know, why you don't make trenches and we get to show Eugene falling back into a trench and get to spend some time with Joel, great. But I do think, yeah, this I like the idea of a Eugene episode being its own thing, because again, at this point in the series, I think it's violence as an expression of love, and what better way to do that than by killing a person who's either in extreme pain or going to turn into a cordyceps zombie.
Sure.
So I'm back on that being something.
Full Joey Pants episode is what you're
full Joey Pants thinking. Episode. Yeah. I mean, the other option would be is not to do a, not to do a full episode, but sort of do like a past arc, like a flashback arc, which I feel is not a good use of those actors they're paying a lot of money for. So yeah. I'm going to say flashback episode.
Yeah. And I definitely don't think it's next week. I was looking through as you were talking here, that just like last week, they released today promotional images for episode 3. And it looks like it's 100% happening in Jackson. There's like shots of obviously Ellie in a cemetery. I imagine they bury Joel, and there's what looks to be a town meeting with the town council facing off with the rest of the citizens there. And then,
ooh,
you know, I imagine they're probably discussing what happened, and maybe that's Tommy trying to, because in the game, we never see Tommy trying to convince the town and Maria to give them people to go after Joel's killers. So maybe we get to see a little bit of that. And then there's Dina and Ellie talking about, I imagine Dina telling her what she knows, and then Ellie and Joel's house. So just a lot of sad processing next week, and we'll see what else they have for us. So it might be a while before we even get to Seattle.
I mean, that's fine with me. Let's use all the story we can. I'm down for it.
Sure.
I very much trust the creative team and the technical execution team at this point. So if they're ready to flex on me for a few episodes, I'm ready to be flexed on. Neil, anything you want to say before we peace out for this week?
I think that's about it. Yeah, for folks that have not played the game, you're not going to believe me when I say this, but Abby is not the villain. This is the worst place to try and convince anyone that you walk away from this show having empathy for both characters, but that you walk away from the story having empathy for both Ellie and Abby. But you know, that's the magic trick that this story pulls off. And I think that the show has done a really good job of setting up people's expectations of hating Abby and seeing her as the villain. Caitlin Dever delivered a really good performance, you know, in service of that goal. And I think that now they have a season and three quarters to pull everybody back the other direction.
Yeah, I think it was Craig Mazin on the official podcast who said, like, everybody's trying to defend the people they love or loved or their community, but the Cordyceps are the only ones that are being really successful at it. And true. that's how you got to watch the show.
The Shamblers are the real heroes. They haven't even shown up yet.
I mean, they are one hive mind, so they really are getting all their goals are getting done. They have overtaken the Earth.
Yeah. Oh, the other thing, Dave, we'll see. This is something I will revise over the next couple of weeks, but I think the Shamblers are probably the most advanced infected we'll get. I think the Rat King is a season three.
No thing. Rat King. I mean, I'm fine with that.
Because it is. The Rat King is an Abby story thing. Like, Abby's the one who comes into contact with the Rat King. And it would be super cool. It's going to be cool whenever they do it, but... If that's the thing that
reminds us Cordyceps is a problem.
Then three. Again, if they get all the way to the theater confrontation between Ellie and Abby, that's after the Rat King. So,
So Rat King, Rat King watch continues. So
get hyped for the Rat King. If we think that that's they're going to get that far, I don't think they are, because again, there's not a whole lot of story after that. There's definitely not a whole season of television after that.
I mean, I think Shambler being the next up, I think that feels right to me. But yeah, Shambler and Rat King, that's a lot of work. Sure. And both on the makeup side and the digital side.
It's a lot of HBO money for the Rat King.
Yeah, we'll get there, though. We'll get there in the next season. So that's going to be it for the Storm portion of the podcast. Make sure to join Neil and I next Wednesday as we talk about whatever's coming in Season 2, Episode 3. Surely nothing bad will happen to anyone. Just a lot. It's going to be a great day to feel sad. So we will see you then. Till then, be excellent to each other.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.